Following morning, we I reported at the recruiting office at the drill hall. When I got there, there was eventually about 120 blokes there. I knew quite a lot of them. Selwyn Lace was there. An old school pal went right through school with them, and he was in the church choir with them. He was going to an infantry regiment. And then Bill Kelly, who worked in the post office with me, he was bound for the same place as me, the Royal Corps of Signals. We were marched from down Hill Street and down to the boat, to a queer procession, all shapes, sizes, and different types of clothes, from all different professions. I just wondered as we were marching down there how different they would look all in uniform. Anyway, when we arrived at Liverpool, we were all split up into different parties, sent to the respective units in all parts of the country. For the Royal Corps of Signals, there was only Bill Kelly and a boy from Ramsey. So we had to report to a holiday camp in North Wales at Prestatyn. It had been a new camp just built a year or so before the war had started, and it had been transformed from a holiday camp into a training camp. We had to report to the company officers and get initiated, and then we got our uniform and kit, and then the three of us, Bill Kelly and this lad from me, Ramsey, and myself, we were got allotted to a chalet. The chalets were concrete built, built in peacetime for the holidaymakers to sleep in. But they were quite comfy, far better than the tents had been in with the Isle of Man Regiment. Three bunks and a wash basin and a mirror end with a shelf above and electric light. We got, the first night we were there, we got making the chalet look as comfortable and homely as we could. It was a lovely night with a clear sky and a full moon. There were loudspeakers placed all around the camp over which at least they played music and records from a control room. The Ramsey lad's name was Arthur Brooks, but he called himself Artie, so Bill and Artie were lying on their bunks when we got straightened up, and I stood in the doorway of the chalet, put the light out and opened the door, and there was Vera Lynn singing We'll Meet Again was playing on the over the tannoy system. Could eat all round the camp. I was thinking of Joyce when I stood there. Bill Kelly says, boy, oh boy, you're miles away, aren't you? So I said, yeah. I said, I'm back in Douglasville. And eventually I shut the door and went for a little walk around the camp before turning in. The following day we were called up by a bugle. You could hear it all over the camp. It must have been the microphone for the tannoy system. You could hear it everywhere. After a hurried wash and a shave, we had to fall in for physical training, PT in shorts and vests. After as much as it was about an hour, I think it was, everybody was feeling ready for a good hearty breakfast. The dining hall was in the centre of the camp, so we marched, fell in on the square, and then marched up in squads to the dining hall. Bill Kelly was put into a different squad to the lad from Ramsey and me. And after breakfast came squad drill, where we had rifles and we had to do rifle drill and marching drill round and round the cement parade ground. Half a dozen squads were parading at one time, the corporals and sergeants shouting all the different commands. The corporal in charge of our squad was a real old soldier. He'd been in the army about 16 or 17 years. He was a short, very short, sturdy man with a neck on him like a bull. And a voice on him, my God, he could shout. He was a fine soldier though, and a nice man when you really got to know him. And all the boys in the squad liked him, you know, and they would do anything for him. The squad was made up of men from all parts, London, Manchester, Eastbourne, Nottingham, Newcastle, and a large percentage of Welshmen. And that became the daily routine. I remember one morning I was up very early and I was standing outside our hut having a breath of fresh air when I saw the bugle coming. Put the bugle to his lips and licked his lips and then put the bugle down again and then put it to his lips again and put it down and licked his lips again, running his tongue around his lips. Just then the sergeant major came along. He says, come on, man, come on. Blow the bloody thing. Don't suck it. What's the matter with you? This lad said, it's cold this morning, sir. It's cold. So sergeant major said to him, well, take the bloody bugle to the cook house. He says, get the cook to put it in the oven. I couldn't help but laugh. And after a few days, square bashing, as they called it, with the rifles, and we started less of the marching and more rifle drill. It was quite funny when lots of these lads had never held a rifle before, trying to hold the guns and do the drills. I couldn't help but I forgot myself, and I could do the rifle drill. Well, I'd been trained in the territorials, you see, and I just couldn't help it. And the corporal noticed this one day, and he said, have you been in the army before? So I said, no, corporal. So he stood looking at me for quite a while, with his legs apart and his hands on his hips. Are you sure, he said. If you weren't in the army, where did you learn to do rifle drill? So I went red and stared back at him and said the first thing that came into my mind, I said, in the boys' brigade, corporal. So the corporal gave a bit of a grin, he said, and he told me to go out in front of the squad and give a demonstration. And then later to take the right-hand man's place in the front row for the purpose of giving the signal by rattling the bolt of the rifle in the drill, the port arms for inspection. After this, the corporal often let me take the squadron drill while he watched. Do quite a few missions in the barracks, and I got friendly with a few of them, and this chap, he started a small dance band. So he got me to join in with them, to play with them and do the vocals. I was singing the vocals. So we got on quite well and started playing small dances in village halls around the area. So I wrote and told Joyce of this, so she was very pleased to hear that I was taken up with the band. At the end of the first month, the squad passed out before the colonel and his staff. The rookies and the awkward squads of the 4 weeks previous, marched past the brigadier, the colonel and minor officers in perfect rhythm and unison. Trained men in foot and rifle drill. So that night, the squad, we had a party at the local pub where we made the guest of honour our corporal who had drilled us and taken us. He'd made soldiers out of us. So we'd all put a bit of money to him, bought him a cheap watch, which one of the lads had engraved on the back. Well, the following day, the boys were all given orders to report to different companies for training in the various trades for which they had applied for. In the Royal Corps of Signals, they're all different trades, linesmen, operators, wireless and keyboard, operators, line operators, dispatch riders, drivers, signalers, instrument mechanics. So everyone received their orders. That was everyone but me. The square in front of the chalets was filled with men, all dressed in full marching dress with their kits standing nearby. Everybody was looking forward to doing their technical training and wishing each other goodbye and good luck. I stood there feeling very sorry, you know, they'd all been such good lads, good comrades, especially these Welsh lads, been full of fun, you know. They'd worked hard and played hard, well together. Not one student the whole month had we had any fights or arguments or bad feeling. I kept wondering why I wasn't being passed on to a trade. I'd applied for training as a dispatch rider. Bill Kelly and Artie from Ramsey came up to say goodbye. Bill Kelly was going to be trained, well, he was a trained operator, keyboard from the post office, the same as myself. So he was going on into that trade. And the lad from Ramsey was going for training as a dispatch rider. A short while after the boys had gone, a chap walked across the square towards me. It was a fellow from another company. I'd piled up with him for a few weeks previous. His name was Cliff Davis, a Welsh boy from Aberdare. "Well, Arthur, I see you're left behind," he said. "So am I. I wonder what it's for." So I turned around and I said, "Oh, Cliff, I think they must have forgotten us. We'd better go and see what it's all about." So the two of us went to the company office, and there we were informed that we were being retained on the staff of the receiving depot of the battalion. The work was partly in the office and on the square, drilling recruits. Well, this went on, days dragged by, sitting in the office and typing, and men out in the square, marching around with the recruits. And then I got my first leave from the signals. So feeling the old self and happy-go-lucky, I went off back home and I met Joyce on the first night back home. We went to our old place and went to the cinema first, and then we went down to the promenade and sat on our old usual seat. It was rather chilly and the moon was hazy and clouds drifting across the sky. And the white top breakers were rolling in from the sea, hitting the sea wall and sending up clouds of spray over the wall. Joyce said it was cold and she wrapped a coat tight round her and she said, "It's a wild night, isn't it, Bing?" I said, "Yeah, it looks like stormy weather. I like listening to the roar of the sea, though. Don't you?" And she said, "Oh, yes." She said, "Are you happy now?" So I said, "I've never been happier in my life. You're back in the khaki." I'm with Harry and the boys in the band at the Bristaton there, and got a good pal, Cliff, playing football with them. And most of all, You're here waiting for me when it's all over. What more can I ask for her? Joyce, she stared out at sea and then turned around and she said, will you be going overseas? So, I said, I will be when the time comes, I suppose. Before I come home, I'd put an application into the captain to ask for being sent to a proper regiment. Joyce snuggled up close, I put my arm round her. Then she says, oh, you got all you wanted and you're happy. Stay that way, Bing. No matter whatever happens. So I sat up and said, what do you mean, Joe? What's going to happen? Is there something wrong? I looked at her, I could see a few tears in her eyes. She said, there's nothing wrong, Bing. Forget I mentioned it. And I gave her a handkerchief and she was dried her eyes. If there's anything worrying you, please tell me. Maybe I can help you. Are you still worrying about not being able to be a nurse? She stood up. She said, yes, that's what it is, Bing. Come on, we'd better be going. It's getting too late. So we got up and I walked home with her. Kissed her goodnight at the doorstep and set off for home myself. The 7 days seemed to fly. Once back at the camp, time seemed to stand still. No reply from the application for a posting. I often wonder where my old terrier pals were, the Manx Regiment. In a newspaper I'd got from home a few weeks previous, I'd read that Pat O'Hare and Hawkeye had transferred to another battery and they'd been reported missing in Norway. It was when the Norway campaign was on. So I read that they were posted as being missing. It wasn't many more weeks before I got a weekend leave, Friday night till Monday night. So I went home, I had to change trains at Chester. I was walking up and down on the platform waiting for the train to Liverpool. And suddenly I heard a voice behind me, hey Arthur. I looked around, there were quite a few people on the platform, but I couldn't see anybody I knew. The voice come again. Bing Adams, don't you know anyone? Then looking round in the doorway of the refreshment room, I saw a soldier standing drinking a cup of tea. Suddenly I recognised him. Pat, you old son of a gun, I shouted. Where have you come from? What? Where? I thought you'd got a packet. Are you going home? Then I was patting the old pal on the shoulder and hugging him. Give over, said Pat, I'm going on leave. I've just got back from Norway. You going home? Yes, I replied. Boy, am I glad to see you, Pat. We'll have to have a celebration when we get home, eh? Just then the train came in and we got on board and we sat talking like a pair of old women. How much we had to ask and tell each other. We got home about 3:30 that afternoon and made arrangements to meet that evening for a celebration. So I walked down after tea, down to the corner of Strand Street and Duke Street, and I found Pat and his father already there waiting. We had a few drinks with his father in the dog's home, and then we went to quite a few pubs, having a drink, and each one was somebody we knew. Everybody was wishing Pat, you know, luck on being rescued and back home, so until we got a bit merry. Unknown to me, Joyce saw us. She was in Strand Street with one of her friends, and I didn't see her. So I carried on with Pat, and we all finished up my sister's chip shop. We had a big feed of fish and chips, and then we come out of the shop in Windsor Road singing, 3 o'clock in the morning, we danced the whole night through. How got home, I can't remember. So Sunday afternoon I went and waited out St. George's Sunday School room where Joyce was teaching. She was quite surprised to see me as I was standing there on the corner. After a few words we went for a walk up to the top of Douglas Head. Sitting down in the grass, Joyce said, "Where did you go to last night, Bing?" So I looked at her. I said, "I met Pat O'Hare at Chester on the way home. I was awfully glad to see that he was safe and sound after being reported missing in Norway. So we went out last night to celebrate. I hope you don't mind." I said, "While I was in the Terriers, Pat was like a brother to me." Joyce looked up and said, "You were drunk, weren't you?" I sat up. I said, "What made you say that, Joe?" She said, "I saw you myself, Ben." I couldn't say a word, and then I said, No, Joe, we weren't drunk. We were only merry. We both felt so glad to see one another. We had a drink too many, maybe, in our excitement. I'm awful sorry, Joe, but I didn't think you would mind the once." She wouldn't look me in the face. She said, "I didn't think you drank, Bing." "I don't," I told her. "It was just last night, it was such a special occasion." So she looked up at me and smiled and said, "All right, Bing, I'll forgive you this once. But don't make a habit of it, please. For me. Will you promise?" "I don't like boys who drink." So I raised my right hand. I said, "I promised you it won't happen again." I bent down and kissed her. The following day, on the Monday morning, I set off back to Prestatyn. Cliff was waiting at the railway station to meet me. So we went to a cinema that night and had a couple of drinks before we made our way back to the camp. 2 days afterwards, I received a letter from Joyce that really broke my heart. This is what she said. "Dear Bing, this letter is to tell you that all has ended between us. I have found out that not only do you break promises, but lately you persist in telling lies. You said that you weren't drunk, but I know that you were. Not only the once, but quite a few times. I'm awful sorry, Bing, but I'm afraid we can't carry on like this. I was going to tell you before you went back on Monday, but I've heard so much about girls having rows with their boys before they went overseas. You're on your own, Bing. Keep on trying hard to get what you want. You'll get it someday. It's no good writing back to me. But by the time you receive this letter, I will be somewhere in England, where I will be for good. Goodbye and good luck. Joyce." I was dumbstruck. I sat down on the bed and read the letter over and over again, as if somebody had just stuck a knife in my heart. The sudden of us all. If only she'd have told me when we were on the Sunday, when we were sitting on the promenade, I could have talked it over with her. Now there was no chance of talking it over, no chance to explain. I wonder where she'd gone to and what she was doing. And thought maybe I'd never see her again. So I got up, put on my uniform and called the next hut. Cliff and we went to the usual drinking place. I started drinking quite hard at that time. Cliff asked me what was the matter, but I wouldn't tell him. Cliff helped me back to the camp and put me to bed, and next day I had an awful head. All through the next day I kept making mistakes in my typing, which Captain told me off 3 or 4 times. To top it all, the captain sent for me the following day. and it was to tell me that I was to be discharged again. The world seemed to collapse all around me. I felt quite well of myself, but it was just as if my heart had been cut out from my breast. I reported to the company office, and the captain said, "Well, Adams," he said, "what is your number?" And I told him, I just forget the number now, it was 233051 or something like that. And he said, "Is that your correct army number?" So I said, "Yes, sir." So he said, "Are you sure it's not 1440601? That was my territorial number." And I guess what was up. He said, "We've had the communication from Army records that you were discharged from the Royal Artillery anti-aircraft unit. Is that correct?" There was no use arguing. They knew. So I was sorry. There was nothing I could do. I just felt absolutely empty. So he said, "I appreciate what you're doing, what you've tried to do," he said, "but I'm afraid that there's no alternative. We must discharge you." So there it was. Back home I would have to go. Back, but what to? There was nothing much to go back before to. My mother had died, Joyce had gone. There'd be absolutely nothing but memories. Cliff, like the true friend that he was, expressed his sympathy, and as we sat in the usual rendezvous that evening, we were both sad at parting, for in the past month we had become real stout, staunch pals. It's wonderful how strong comradeship grows in the army between men who before joining up had never known or seen each other before. Seemingly out of nowhere, Cliff Davis had come into my life, and now, just as he had arrived, he was going out. Still, I left with memories of happy hours spent together at Prestatyn with Cliff. He was a born comedian, a good footballer, and really good company. I'd made many good friends in the Corps of Signals, and a very good friend indeed with the Sergeant Major, whose office I worked in. He was a married man and he lived in Birkenhead. So quite often on the weekend, when he used to get weekend leave, he used to say to me, "Have you any relations or friends nearby that you could spend a weekend with?" Well, I had a cousins who lived in Port Sunlight, near Birkenhead. They'd visited us before the war. My cousin Jim Pendlebury with his son Jim and Eric and the daughter Betty. Well, Jim was away in the army, but Betty and the younger brother Jim were still at home, so the Sergeant Major had a little two-seater sports car, an MG, and when he had a weekend leave, he granted me a weekend leave and drove me up and dropped me off at Port Sunlight. And then on the Friday night, and then on the Sunday evening, he would pick me up and drive me back to the camp. He was a very good friend indeed. I had quite a few nice weekends at Port Sunlight. Now all that had finished. Now, back on the island, life once more became an endless series of monotonous days and empty, lonely nights. I found out where Joyce had moved to. I'd met her brother, Leslie, and he told me she had become a probationer nurse at the Sunshine Home for Blind Babies, belonging to the National Institute of the Blind. It was situated in Birkdale, near Southport, facing the sea in a direct line with Douglas. So all that was between us was 60-odd miles of the Irish Sea. I felt happy for her in a way. She had made the first step in realizing her ambition. How happy it must have made her. Her years of childhood playing with dolls, pretending that she was a nurse. Years of dreaming when her childhood make-believe would become reality. At last she had succeeded. Her day had arrived. How proud she must have felt. And that was only the beginning. She had made a start, and from there on she would rise and rise until she attained her final ambition. But as for me, I was real miserable and lonely. Eventually I wrote to her to try and gain forgiveness. I explained everything as best as I could. I even told her my secret about suffering from epilepsy and how I'd taken a drink to overcome the torture it brought. I felt that if she knew, she might understand and forgive. A few days later, I got a reply, and the contents amazed me. She said, "Dear Bing, I knew all along about your suffering from that complaint. Why didn't you tell me yourself? I was terribly disappointed and ashamed of you when you took to drink. That won't cure you, but bring your life quicker to a sudden end. For your health's sake, Bing, give it up. I feel awfully sorry and worried about you. You ask me if there is anyone else. No, there is no one else. No one I could ever feel the same for. I will carry on writing to you as a friend, but we can never be the same as we were before. I still feel that you are my best friend. If ever I was worried or came across any trouble, you would be the first I would turn to. I want you to feel the same way about me. Carry on with your plans for the band you've dreamed about. Forget the past. Start anew and make all those dreams come true. I have made a start in making my ambition turn into reality. Don't let me beat you in getting to the top. Try it, Bing, for me. I still have faith in you. In your next letter, I hope to hear you have made your mind up. Good night and God bless you, Joyce." I read it over and over and over again, pondering over each word. How did she know? Who had told her? Still she knew, and she still had faith in me. Between the lines, I could see that she still cared for me. I just had to prove myself worthy of her affection. So there and then, I made my mind up to carry out her wish and start and build up the dream I'd so long wanted and sighed for. And I made my mind up that nothing this time would stop me. Maybe when the job was completed and the war was over, we could forget their past and find ultimate happiness and the fruits of success with a homestead in Canada, which Joyce had so often told me was her greatest dream. I pictured that many times. In the days that followed, I kept on writing to her and getting replies which spurred me on with greater enthusiasm. I went and got in touch with my old pal and former choir boy pal, Lenny Hewden. He'd been turned down for military service as being medically unfit, but he still played the piano, so I joined up with him and he appeared in a few concerts singing duets at the piano. And then I bought a set of dance drums. It was the chap who used to play had a little band on the ferries running from the Victoria Pier to Douglas Head. Johnny Ventro, he played the violin. I bought this set of drums from him and played with him, and then I contacted a young lad of 16 who played some terrific swing piano solos. He was a schoolboy at school with my sister Winnie's eldest boy. Freddie Callow, his name was, but he had wore thick glasses and a drawn sort of a face, and at school, in quite dark skin, one of the schoolboys called him Gandhi. For why, what reason, I don't know, but he was an extremely nice lad, so that was two pianos and a set of drums. And Freddie Callow was really good on the violin, too. The violin was his first instrument. He had the technique of a first-class musician. He was really good. Later, I found a lad who played guitar, and that made us up into a quartet. Then I found a young lad, a friend of mine, his brother, worked in the government office at the time. Bruce Brides, and his brother Philip was a pal of mine. He'd worked as a telegraph boy in the post office. Anyway, Bruce worked in the government office, and he knew a lad who worked there with him who played the saxophone. So I brought him into the group. Now, in Douglas during the war, the two main dance halls were the Pally D Dance in Strand Street and the Villa Marina. They were both quite modern ballrooms. The one in Strand Street, the Pally D Dance, was only built in the early 30s. And I was determined that we would play there some eventually. I tried every way we could to get the chance to give us the break. But that the Pally D Dance before the war, a local chap named Harold Morehouse had a band there. And then he got called up for the forces during the war. And an English chap came. He played the trombone with Carol Gibbons and the Savoy Hotel Orpheans at the Savoy Hotel in London. How he comes to be the Isle of Man, I don't know. He seemed quite a well-built, fit man. He could blow a trombone like mad. Why he wasn't called up for the forces, I don't know, but he formed a band and he played in the Pally D Dance. And outside there was a big advert, and the main name was, his name was in small letters, Sam Akers. Name was Sam Akers, and underneath were big letters, Carol Gibbons and the Savoy Hotel Orpheans. And to, when you first stopped to look at the advert, you would think Carol Gibbons and his famous band were playing there, but when you looked at the smaller writing, it was Sam Akers, late of Carol Gibbons. Well, he had the band at the Pally D Dance, and he was quite good too. He was a good trombonist. I wasn't in that league, but I kept on trying, and we got more and more little dances, and I called it Arthur Adams and his Rhythm Boys. Oh, I was desperate to make a break, because when I went back to the post office again to work, but by that time all the regular staff had been called up or volunteered for the forces, except for about three older men who were too old for military service. So I was the only trained regular post office clerk working there at the time. And they had some temporary staff, a couple of men. One was 70, turned 70, I believe. Called himself John R. Lewin. He'd been a reporter on a newspaper in Liverpool in his younger days, so he told me. And the other one was a humorous sort of a man, but he very, very lazy, called Ned Askew. And he was very humorous, but he didn't like work too much. I remember I went for a drink with them one night when we had a break, half an hour's break or so. We used to slip, there was a public house just across the road from the post office called the Apple Hotel. At the moment, it's in the process of being knocked, demolished. But I went in there with Ned one night, and he had his dog with him, a little dog. And this dog was only a mongrel, lovely little terrier, white with brown spots on it, was sitting by the stool, he was sitting at the bar. And the place was crowded with sailors and airmen and what have you. And one of these sailors started, he was eating crisps, and he gave the Ned's dog some. And he was talking away to it. Then he said to Ned, "What's your dog's name?" And Ned said, "Ask him." So the sailor looked at him. The sailor had a few drinks. He said, "Beg your pardon." He said, "But what is the dog's name?" Ned said, "Ask him." So he said this about three times, and the sailor then said, "Are you trying to make me look stupid or something?" So Ned said, no, that is the dog's name, ask him." So this fella said, "And who are you?" So I grabbed Ned by the arm and pulled him out. I didn't want him to say, "Ask you." So I say, his name was Ned Askew, and the dog was Ask Him. And we had two shifts at work. Sometimes it was all night, from 11 o'clock till 7 in the morning. Well, if Ned was on with me, I'd be working away, and he'd say, "Oh, I'll go upstairs and put the kettle on, make a cup of tea." Well, an hour and a half after, I'd knock off to go and see where my cup of tea was, and Ned would be curled up in a chair, fast asleep. Oh, it was hard going. And then there was one of the postmen who worked in the office. He had a daughter, Eddie Collister, this postman's name, wasn't he? Had a daughter named Maisie, and she'd done nights with me, and she'd be out dancing and come straight from the dance to work, and she'd be tired too. She'd go up the retiring room and have 40 winks. So I was getting fed up with the work in the post office, because people don't realise that there was so much work there during that period of time. I mean, so the army was stationed there, guarding the prisoners of war. There were thousands of prisoners of war. There was a naval air station, Fleet Air Arm Place, at the south of the island. And there was a naval training for radar. They had a big depot there, and Cunningham's camp had been trained into a boys' training depot. There were a few thousand there. The Royal Naval School of Music from Deal in Kent, they'd come to a place, a camp on the island. And all this mail, these prisoners of war, they used to get Red Cross parcels, and lots of them were broken. And that was my job to repair them. So the regular staff who worked there, when they come back after the war, they didn't realise. We were dealing with more post, probably, than what the island was dealing with before the war, with the full staff there. I would work all night, get home about 7:30, and go to bed to have a sleep, and then my sister would wake me about 12 o'clock. There'd be a message from the telegraph boy come up with a note, could I go in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to do extra work, extra overtime. So it was getting me down, really. Anyway, I kept on sending away for orchestrations, work out the band, get the band going, and I bought music desks with AA, Arthur Adams, on the front, and Lenny managed to hire a small hall at the church where we used to go to run our own dances and rehearse in. So first we played to practically no one there, but we practiced and practiced. And I managed to get in touch with the Royal Naval School of Music, the Royal Marines Band, and I managed to get two saxophonists, two blokes on the saxophone, one tenor and one alto, and a trumpeter. And we got a really good band started. We started getting more engagements, more and more. The band became very good. One of my main regrets is that they didn't have tape recorders in those days, so that we could have recorded some of our playing, because I don't like boasting, but I really felt, and other people told us, that we really had a good, hot, jivey rhythm band. I'd always been a fan of Harry Roy's, as I mentioned at the start of this story, and I liked playing his numbers, which were always bright, snappy and happy tunes. I liked that sort of rhythm, and especially with the two pianos. Oh, we were playing all the hits of the day, real typical jazz, and these musicians from the Marines Band, they had been posted there to be instructors, so they were all first class musicians. Occasionally when we had a bigger dance to play at, I hired a few extra. I wasn't making any money out of it, because the nights we weren't playing, we used to meet and go and have a drink together. But it was a happy time, and I kept my promise to Joyce. Whenever we played a waltz, the old time waltzes, it was always a Strauss waltz. And we all always made sure that when it came to waltz time, we played Strauss, Johann Strauss. Tales of the Vienna Woods, the Blue Danube. One Day When We Were Young, Artist's Life. It was always Strauss for a waltz.